Oh, it's his history. His Brunzi. He's solidly grounded. And he was perfectly adapted to that ancient form of weaving, where you can't tell rhythm from lead guitar. The style I developed with Brian, the old bedrock of the Rolling Stones sound. The division between guitar players, rhythm and lead that we had with Mick Taylor melted away. You have to be intuitively locked to do that, and Ronnie and I are like that. Beast of Burden is a good example of the two of us twinkling felicitously together. So we said, let's get it on. It was going to be temporary, and let's see how it works. So Ronnie came on the 1975 tour of the USA, even though he wasn't officially a member of the band. Ronnie is the most malleable character I've ever met, and a real chameleon. He doesn't really know who he is. It's not insincere. He's just looking for a home. He has a sort of desperation for brotherly love. He needs to belong. He needs a band. Ronnie's a very tight family man. He's had a bit of a rough time. His mum and dad and both of his brothers have died in the past few years. It's tough. You say, hey, Ron, sorry about that. He says, well, what do you expect? Everyone has their time. But Ronnie sometimes doesn't let it out. He holds it in for a long time. Without his mum, Ronnie is sort of lost. Being the youngest in the family, he was mum's boy. And I know I'm the same way. Ronnie holds it in a lot. He's a tough little sod, fucking gypo. The last family of water gypsies to come onto dry land. Some fantastic moment of evolution. Though sometimes I don't think Ronnie's shed his fins. Perhaps that's why he's always falling off the wagon. He doesn't like being dry. He wants to get back into the wet. One difference between Ronnie and me is he was an over-the-top man. He had no control whatsoever. I'm a bit of a drinker, let's say. But Ronnie was everything to the max. I can get up and take a drink, but Ronnie's breakfast used to be a White Cloud tequila and water. If you gave him real cocaine, he didn't like it, because what he'd been taking was speed, except he paid cocaine prices for it, and he'd try and drill it into his head. You're not taking coke, you're taking speed. You've just been sold speed at cocaine prices. At the same time, it's not as if he was discouraged from these habits in his new job. There was one memorable initiation of Ronnie just before the USA tour at the end of March 1975. We were rehearsing the band in Montauk, Long Island, and we decided to pay a visit to Freddie Sessler, who was living then in Dobbs Ferry, just up the Hudson River from Manhattan. Freddie dared us to consume an ounce of pharmaceutical there and then. It was basically like ripping three pages out of your diary. Freddie's notes enlighten us about this, because I remember very little. I was deeply asleep about 5 a.m. when I heard an enormous knock at the front door of my house. With my eyes closed, I managed to open the door. I was immediately greeted and awakened to Keith's sense of humor. What the fuck are you doing sleeping while we're working our asses off and just drove 100 miles to visit you? Okay, I said. I'm up. Just let me wash my face. And I grabbed an orange juice for myself and handed a bottle of Jack Daniels to Keith. At once he inserted a cassette in the deck of the stereo of some reggae music, at full blast, of course, and it was party time. Within a few moments, I asked Keith and Ronnie if they would care to join in a wake-up toast. I was holding in my hand a 1-ounce bottle of Merc, went into the bedroom, reached for a painting framed in glass, and decided to play a game of my own devising. One of my biggest pleasures has always been the ritual of opening a sealed bottle of cocaine. Just looking, staring at it, breaking the seal, I would get an instant rush, euphoria. It was a bigger pleasure than actually consuming the cocaine itself. As I broke the seal, I emptied on the glass 2/3 of the bottle. Then I prepared 2 equal piles of about 8 grams each for Keith and myself, and about 4 grams for Ronnie. When completed, I said the following to Keith. "Keith, I would like to test you. What kind of man you are, knowing very well he would stand up to any challenge." I made 2 lines, grabbed a straw, and with swift action snorted my share of 8 grams. "Now, let me see if you can do that." In my entire adult life, I had never, ever seen anyone indulging in a quantity of this magnitude. Keith looked, stared, grabbed the straw, and duplicated my effort with no difficulties. I passed the 4 grams to Ronnie, saying, "You are a junior. That's all you get. Do it." He did it. Pharmaceutical cocaine cannot be compared in any way to cocaine produced in Central or South America. It is pure and does not bring on depression or lethargy. A totally different type of euphoria. One of creativity exists immediately when it is absorbed by the central nervous system. There are absolutely no withdrawal symptoms. As I passed the line to Ronnie, I was ready to hit the ceiling, an enormous rush. Oh, shit. What a sensation. Absolutely nothing I knew of could compare. As I offered Ronnie his line, those were the last words to come out of my mouth for the next 6 hours. We embarked on a journey to Woodstock. Pure cocaine. Are you going to go for it or not? Then jump in the car and drive. We had no idea where we went. It was kind of like the drive I did with John Lennon. We just went. I've no idea how we got anywhere. Obviously, I drove, and very responsibly, never got pulled over. We gassed up, we did everything, but in another head. I had sketchy reports that we stayed overnight in Bearsville with the band, probably with Levon Helm. I don't know if there was any aim in going there. Did we want to go and see somebody? I don't think Bob Dylan was living up there at the time. We made it back to Dobbs Ferry eventually. I have a weird feeling that Billy Preston was there, but he didn't come on the drive. The 1975 tour on which we were about to embark was fueled by Merc cocaine. It was when we initiated the building of hideaways behind the speakers on the stage so that we could have lines between songs. One song, one bump, was the rule between Ronnie and me. Even then, 3 years after the STP tour, it was an extraordinarily ramshackle affair by today's standards. How was it done then? Listen to Mary Beth Medley. She was the tour coordinator. She put the dates together and did the deals with the promoters across the USA. She was 27, working under Peter Rudge. She had no staff. It was done on 3x5 index cards. I tell this to people, and they look at me like I'm talking Swahili. A Rand McNally Highway Mileage Guide. A map of the United States. No fax. No cell phone. No FedEx. No computer. A Rolodex, but nothing other than a regular phone line. And a telex to Europe to the office. As to the rock and roll lifestyle, you might have thought we'd have learnt the lessons of caution after the incident in Fordyce. But there was another incident after that, at the end of the tour in August 1975, that's never been related, as far as I know. It involves Keith, but it involves everybody. We were in Jacksonville, Florida, and we were going to Hampton, Virginia. And Bill Carter had heard that the plane was going to be searched when we got there. He had these police connections all over the place. We had gone through this scare once in Louisville, Kentucky, where they just came on the plane. And so to avoid that, we collected everyone's contraband, everyone's guns, knives, drugs, anything that could be considered illegal, and packed it in two suitcases. And I took a private plane from Jacksonville to Hampton, Virginia, with these two suitcases, and drove to the hotel. The plane ride I wasn't worried about. With private planes, you didn't even have to fill out a manifest in those days. I think I went anonymously. The drive was nerve-wracking. I was going 50 miles an hour, just me. And then I got to the hotel, I went into a room, not mine, and put it all out on the bed. And as they came in, a couple of hours later, they all picked up their stuff. Annie Leibovitz has a picture somewhere of the treasure that was in those suitcases. Chapter 10, in which Marlon becomes my road companion. Our son, Tara, dies. We move in with John Phillips and family in Chelsea. I get busted in Toronto and charged with trafficking. I give up heroin with the help of a black box and Jack Daniels. The Stones record Some Girls in Paris. I meet Lil Virgilis, who helps me clean up. I'm given probation in 1978 on condition I give a concert for the blind. Anita's boyfriend shoots himself playing Russian roulette, and she and I finally part. There have been so many close shaves. The bust at Fordyce during the 1975 tour was potentially the most lethal. I had used up all my cat lives. No use counting. Closer shaves were to come, busts and stray bullets and cars flying off the road. Some escapes had a measure of luck about them, but there was a darkness in the air, a storm coming. I saw Ushi again. She joined the tour in San Francisco for a week and then disappeared for many years. The Rolling Stones spent some time that autumn in Switzerland, since that was my home, working more on the album Black and Blue. The album, whose promotion featuring a half-naked, bruised and bound woman and led to a call for a boycott of Warner Communications. We worked on songs such as Cherry O' Baby, Fool to Cry and Hot Stuff. In Geneva, in March of 1976, Anita gave birth to our third child, a boy we named Tara. He was barely a month old when I left Anita to go on a long European tour that was to run from April until June. I took Marlon with me as my road buddy. He was 7 years old. Anita and I had become two junkies living separate existences, except trying to bring up kids. Most of it was actually not that difficult for me because I was on the road so much and now Marlon was usually with me. But it was not a pleasant atmosphere. It's very difficult living with your old lady who's also a junkie. In fact, a bigger one than you are. The only thing Anita ever said to me then was, "Has it arrived?" The only important thing in life was the stuff. And she had started to get really far out. A crash in the middle of the night, and she'd have thrown a whole bottle of cranberry juice or wine down the hall of the renter house we'd just moved into. "Oh, do you need some stuff, darling?" I understood, but it needn't include redecorating the fucking house. By now, she wasn't touring with us or coming to recording sessions. She was more and more isolated. The more the shit hit the fan, the more I kept the boy with me. I'd never had a son before, so it was a great thing to watch him grow up, to say, "I need your help, boy." So Marlon and I became a team. Angela in 1976 was still too young for the road. We took ourselves to the gigs in this great car of mine. Marlon was my navigator. In those days, there were countries. It wasn't just borderless Europe. I gave him a position, a job to do. "You know, here's the map. Tell me when we get to the border." To get from Switzerland to Germany, we went through Austria. So you're talking Swiss border, boom, into Austria, bang. 50 miles through Austria, bang, into Germany. You're talking a lot of borders just to get to Munich. So you had to be very precise, especially in the snow and ice. Marlon was on the case. He would say, "15 clicks from the border, Dad." That was when to pull over, have a shot, and either dump it or resort your shit. Sometimes he'd give me a nudge and say, "Dad, time to pull over. You're falling, you're slipping." He acted beyond his age, necessary when we were being busted. "Dad?"
"Yeah?"
He's waking me up, shaking me. "The men in the blue suits are downstairs." It wasn't that often that I was late for a show, and I never missed one. But when I was late, I was spectacularly late. And it was usually a great show anyway. My experience, crowds don't mind waiting as long as you turn up, you deliver. It was that half-hippie fog, dope fog. In the 70s, showtime was when I woke up. I might have been 3 hours late, but there was no such thing as curfews for shows. If you went to see a show, you would be there for the whole night. Nobody said it would start on time. If I was late, sorry, but it was just the right time for the show. Nobody left. But I didn't push my luck. I kept these late shows to a minimum. Usually, if I was late, it was because I was deeply asleep. I remember Marlon having to wake me up. It became a habit, actually. Jim Callahan and the security knew I had a shooter under the pillow, and they didn't want to wake me up. Half an hour before we were due on stage, they'd send Marlon, shove him into the room. "Dad!" Marlon got the hang of it real quick. He knew what to say. "Dad, it really is time," things like that. "That means 2 more hours, doesn't it?" "Dad, I held him off." He was a great minder. I was a bit unpredictable in those days, or they thought I was. I never shot anybody, but there was always that fear that I might wake up in one of those moods and grab the gun, thinking I was being robbed. It's not as if I haven't nurtured that a bit. It comes in handy. I never meant to stick people up, but it was a rough schedule. I had a kid with me on the road, and I was pretty fucked up. Usually, when I got on stage, I just got up. Getting out of bed is one thing, waking up is another. It takes me 3 or 4 hours. Then I've got to put the rig on. The shortest time between getting out of bed and getting on stage was probably one of those where I was supposed to be on stage an hour ago. What am I wearing? Pajamas, Daddy? Okay, quick, where's me fucking pants? Usually I'd crashed out in what I was wearing to play anyway. Half an hour later, it's, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Rolling Stones." It's an interesting wake-up call. Let Marlin tell it. The 76 tour was in Europe, and that's why I went on the tour with them for the whole summer and ended up at the Nebworth concert in August when they played with Zeppelin. They'd asked me to wake Keith up because he did have a bad temper. He didn't like being woken up. So Mick or someone would come to me and say, "We've got to leave in a few hours. Why don't you wake your dad up?" I was the only one capable of doing it without getting my head bitten off. I'd say, "Dad, get up. You've got to get on the road. You've got to leave. You've got to get on the plane." And he'd do it. He was very sweet. We'd go to gigs and then come back. I don't really remember too much back and out, really. We shared a room with two beds. I'd wake him up and order breakfast from room service, ice cream for breakfast or cake. And the waitresses would often be very condescending to me. "Oh, poor little boy." And I'd tell them to fuck off. I found that really annoying. And I got wise pretty quick to the hangers-on and people who'd try to get to Keith through me. I got very used to getting rid of them too, saying, "Look, I don't want to see you here. Go away." Keith would say, "Oh, I've got to put Marlin to bed to get rid of people." And to some girls or dodgy types, I'd say, "Fuck off. Dad's asleep. Leave us alone." They wouldn't say anything to a kid, so they would obey. I do remember Mick on that tour was quite sweet. We were in Germany, Hamburg, and Keith was asleep, and Mick invited me to his room. I'd never had a hamburger, and he ordered me one. "You've never had a hamburger, Marlin? You've got to have a hamburger in Hamburg." So we sat there and had dinner. He was very friendly and charming at that time. He really got to Keith, too. He was very nurturing. He took care of him. That stood out. And at that point, Keith was in such a state. Keith would always read me stories. We used to love Tintin and Asterisk, but he couldn't read French, and they were French editions, so he'd make the whole bloody thing up. It was only after years that I realized, when I read a Tintin, that he didn't know what the hell the story was about. He'd bluffed his way through the whole thing. Given all the smack, nodding out, and that sort of thing, that is quite remarkable. I do recall I only had one pair of shoes and one pair of trousers, and I just wore them to death for the whole tour. There were the bodyguards, Bob Bender and Bob Kowalski, the two Bobs. They were both 6 foot, and they were huge guys, walls, mountains. One was blonde and one was dark-haired, and they were like bookends. I used to play chess with them in the hallway, because that's what they'd do, sit out in the hallway and play chess to pass the time. It was really fun. That whole time it didn't seem traumatic. It seemed like a laugh, going to concerts every night in a different city. I'd be up until 5 in the morning sometimes, go to sleep till 3 in the afternoon. It was all on Keith's routine. I was never even curious about drugs. I found all those people bloody ridiculous. I just found it really silly what they were doing. Anita tells me I did smoke lots of spliffs when I was 4 or so in Jamaica. But I don't believe that at all. That sounds like an Anita story. I found the drugs repulsive, but I did learn to clean it up and not to touch it, not to leave it lying around. If I saw it, I'd put it away. And there was always the occasion where I'd pick up a magazine or a book and lines of blow would be on it and would go all over the place. Keith wouldn't get too mad. At the end of that tour, we had a car crash driving back from Nebworth. That's the one when Keith was arrested. He fell asleep and ploughed into a tree. 7 of us were in the car and no one was seriously hurt because, luckily again, that was the Bentley. That car's actually felt quite a bit. Until 5 or 6 years ago, there was still my bloody handprint on the back seat. And on the dashboard, there was still the dent where my nose hit it. I was impressed having a dent in the dashboard, and disappointed when it was repaired. I'm a good driver. I mean, nobody's perfect, right? Somewhere I lost it, fell asleep. I just passed out. We skidded off the road. All I hear is Freddie Sessler in the back going, Jesus fucking Christ. But I managed to get it off the road and into a field, which is, after all, the sensible thing to do. At least we didn't hit anybody. We didn't kill anybody. We didn't even hurt ourselves. Then the cops found acid in my jacket. How did I get out of this one? We just finished a show. The jackets we were wearing were like band jackets, same shape, but different colours. It could have been Mick Jagger's one. It could have been Charlie's that I picked up. It could have been anybody's jacket. That was my defence. I did make some speech along the lines of, this is my life. This is the way we live and shit happens. You don't live like me. I do what I have to do. If I fuck up, I'm very sorry. I'm just living a peaceful life. Let me get to the next gig. In other words, hey, it's only rock and roll. But tell that to a bunch of Aylesbury plumbers. Maybe he charmed the jurors, so one report said. It's hard to believe because my attitude was, I need a jury that's at least half full of rock and roll guitar players to have anybody know what the fuck I'm talking about. A jury of my peers would be Jimmy Page, a conglomeration of musicians, guys that have been on the road and know what's what. My peers are not some lady doctor and a couple of plumbers. As far as that's English law, I respect it very much. But do me a favour. And they basically got that. No one, it seems, this time was trying to teach me a lesson. And they let me off with a fine and a slight slap on the wrist. I was in Paris with Marlon on tour when I got the news that our little son, Tara, aged just over 2 months, had been found dead in his cot. I got the phone call as I was getting ready to do the show, and it's a sorry to tell you, which hits you like a gunshot. And no doubt you're going to want to cancel the show. And I thought about it for a few seconds, and I said, of course we're not cancelling. It would be the worst possible thing, because there was nowhere else to go. What am I going to do, drive back to Switzerland and find out what didn't happen? It's happened already. It's done. Or sit there and mope and go bananas and get into, what? Why? I called Anita, of course, and she was in tears, and the details were all confusing. Anita had to stay there and take care of the cremation and all of the argy-bargy from the Swiss coroners before she could come to Paris, and all I could do then was to protect Marlon from it, try not to bounce everything onto him. The only thing that kept me going through that was Marlon and the day-to-day work of taking care of a 7-year-old on the road. I don't have enough time to cry about this. I've got to make sure this kid is all right. Thank God he was there. He was too young to really get the drift on it. The only upside in this respect is at least Marlon and I were away from the immediate grief. I had to go on stage that night. After that, it was ploughing on through the tour with Marlon and keeping that separated. It made Marlon and me tighter, no matter what. I've lost my second son. I ain't gonna lose the first. What happened? Well, I know very little about the circumstances. All I knew about Tara was this beautiful little boy in the cradle. Hey, little bugger, I'll see you when I get back off the road, right? He seemed perfectly robust. He looked like a miniature Marlin. Never knew the son of a bitch, or barely. I changed his nappy twice, I think. It was respiratory failure, cot death. Anita found him in the morning. I wasn't about to ask questions at the time. Only Anita knows. As for me, I should never have left him. I don't think it's her fault. It was just a crib death. But leaving a newborn is something I can't forgive myself for. It's as if I deserted my post. Anita and I, to this day, have never talked about it. I dropped it because I didn't want to open old wounds. If Anita wanted to sit around and talk to me about it, I might, but I couldn't bring it up. It's too painful. Neither of us, I'm sure in her case too, have got over it. You don't get over these things. At the time, it certainly further eroded our relationship, and Anita descended further into fear and paranoia. It's no question that losing a child is the worst thing that can ever happen, which is why I wrote to Eric Clapton when his son died, knowing something of what he was going through. When that happens, you go totally numb for a while. It's only very slowly that the possibilities of your love for the little chap emerge. You can't deal with it all at once. And you can't lose a kid without it coming to haunt you. Everything's supposed to go in its natural order. I've seen my mum and my dad off, and that's the natural order. But seeing a baby off is another thing. It never lets you rest. Now it's a permanent cold space inside me. Just selfishly, if it had to happen, I'm glad it happened then, when he was too young to form a relationship. Now he bangs into me once a week or so. I have a boy missing. Could have been a contender. I wrote in my notebook when I was working on this book. Once in a while, Tara invades me. My son. He would be 30-odd now. Tara lives inside me. But I don't even know where the little bugger is buried, if he's buried at all. That same month that Tara died, I looked at Anita and saw that there was only one place Angela could go while we sorted this out, to my mother. and by the time we could even think about her returning to us, she was ensconced in Dartford with Doris. So I thought, better leave her with Mum. She's got a settled life. No more of this madness for her. She can grow up a normal kid. And she has, and brilliantly. Doris was in her 50s, and she could bring up another kid. Given the chance and the possibility, she took it on. She and Bill did it together. I knew I was going to be busted again and again and again, and what was the point of bringing up a daughter knowing that the cops were at the door? At least I knew there was a shelter for Angela in my mad world. And Angela stayed with Doris for the next 20 years. I kept Marlon with me on the road until the tour ended that August. I packed all my stuff up at the Wick when Ronnie Wood emigrated for tax reasons to America that year, 1976. We couldn't go back to Cheney Walk because of the 24-hour patrols and the, oh, hello, Keith. If we stayed there, it was with windows closed and curtains closed. A hermetic existence, a real siege drawn into ourselves. We were just trying to stay alive and stay one step ahead of the law all the time. Always travelling. A phone call in front. Can you get needles there? Mundane fucking junky shit. It was a prison of my own making. We lived for a while at the Ritz Hotel in London until we were forced to flee on account of our room being in need of refurbishment, courtesy of Anita. Marlon began going to school for the first time properly to Hill House, a school where they wore orange uniforms and seemed to spend much time walking in crocodile lines through the streets of London. The boys of Hill House were a London institution, like the Chelsea pensioners. Marlon, needless to say, found this a profound shock, or what he terms in retrospect, a bloody nightmare. At this moment, John Phillips, of the disbanded Mamas and Papas, was living in London. He and his new wife, the actress Genevieve Waite, and his small child, Tamerlane, had a house in Glebe Place, Chelsea. And we took refuge there for a time. We moved in. There were already plans to work together for Rolling Stones Records to produce John's solo album, with Ronnie, Mick Taylor, and me playing on it. Ahmet Ertegun was funding it from Atlantic Records. Good idea, too, on paper. John was a great guy, really funny, and interesting to work with, although he was nuts. He'd written almost all those songs for the Mamas and others that defined a certain period, some with his ex-wife, Michelle Phillips, California Dreamin', Monday Monday, San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair. Phillips was amazing. I've never known anybody to be so hooked on dope so quick. And I had something to do with it. The night Ronnie was leaving the Wick, John had called up and said, I've got a bottle of this stuff called Merc. And he said, does anybody have some use for it? I don't do that stuff. I said I would drop by on my way out of Ronnie's. I left the Wick and went straight to John's joint. We were playing and everything, and he'd shown me the bottle. We were there 2 or 3 hours, and I said, John, can I use your John? I've got to take a hit. So I went in the John, shut up. I mean, I didn't want to pull it in front of the family or anything like that. And when I came out, John said, what was that you were doing? Oh, John, it's called Smack. and I did the thing I never, or very rarely, did. I think it was the only time. You don't turn other people on. You keep it to yourself. He'd just given me this cocaine, and I felt, well, you want to know what I'm doing? Here we go. So I shot him up, just in the muscle. I always felt responsible for John because I turned him on to smack. Within a week, he's got a pharmacy under control and he's become a dealer. I've never seen a guy become a junkie that quick. Usually it takes months, sometimes years, for a guy to get hooked, hooked, hooked. But John, 10 days later, he's running the show. It changed his life. He moved back to New York, and so did I the following year, when even greater madness took place, but more of that later. The music we played together with Mick and others was released after John's death in 2001, with the title Pay, Pack, and Follow. Anita, Marlon, and I moved around. We stayed in Blake's hotel. We didn't last long there either, so we moved into a rented house in Old Church Street in Chelsea, recently vacated by Donald Sutherland. It was here in this house where Anita really lost it with me. She had become delusional, very paranoid. It was one of her darkest periods, and it developed with the dope. Wherever she went, she was convinced that someone had left a stash before, doing a runner. She'd take the whole place apart, looking for it. The bathroom at the Ritz, sofas, wallpaper, panelling. I remember once I took her in the car and told her to concentrate on the number plates. Something mundane to try and calm her, connect her to reality. We made a pact, at her request, that I would never take her to the nut house. I like a high-spirited woman. And with Anita, you knew you were taking on a Valkyrie. She who decides, who dies in battle. But she went right off the rails, became lethal. Anita had rage whether there was dope or not. But if there was no dope, she'd go crazy. Marlon and I used to live in fear of her sometimes, of what she would do to herself, let alone to us. I used to take him downstairs to the kitchen and we'd hunker down and say, wait for Mum to get over it. She was slinging shit about, which might have hit the kid. You'd come back to the house and the walls were covered in blood or wine. You didn't know what was going to happen next. We would be there just hoping that she'd stay asleep and not wake up in one of her screaming fits, raging at the top of the stairs like Betty Davis, throwing glass objects at you. She was a tough bitch. No, there wasn't a lot of fun for a while with Anita in the middle 70s. She became unbearable. She was a real bitch to me, a bitch to Marlon. She was a bitch to herself. And she knows it, and I'm saying it here in this audio book. Basically, I was looking at how the hell do I get out of there without screwing it up with the kids. I loved her dearly. I don't get that involved with women if I don't love them dearly. I always feel it's my failure if it doesn't work, if I can't pull it together and make it all right. But with Anita, I couldn't make it right. She was unstoppably self-destructive. She was like Hitler. She wanted to take everything down with her. I tried to clean up loads of times, but not Anita. She would go the other way. Any suggestion of it, and she'd go into rebellion mode. And if anything, take more. Domestic duties at this point were not something she took on gladly. I said, "What the fuck am I doing?" "Okay, she's the mother of my children. Swallow it. I love the woman. I'd do anything. She's got a problem. I'll take over. I'll help out." Unscrupulous is not a bad word for her. I don't mind flinging it in her face right now, and she knows it. It's up to her to live with. I just did what I had to do. Anita will still have to wonder how the hell she screwed up. I'd still be with her right now. I'm never one to change, especially with the kids. Anita and I can now sit around at Christmas time with our grandchildren and give each other a bemused smile. "Hey, you silly old cow, how you doing?" Anita's in good shape. She's become a benign spirit. She's a marvelous granny. She's survived. But things could have been better, baby. I sealed myself off much of the time from Anita, or she didn't care to join us in the studio at the top of the house. She spent most of her time in the Donald Sutherland Memorial bedroom, which had massive chains hanging from the wall, purely decorative, but giving an overall S&M feel to the room. Regulars came by, Stash, Robert Fraser. I was seeing a lot of the Monty Python people at the time, particularly Eric Idle used to come up and hang. It was in this Church Street period that I achieved my longest feat of merc-assisted wakefulness, a 9-day epic of no sleep. I was still going on the 9th day. I may have had a couple of snoozes, but no more than 20 minutes. I was busy doing my sounds, transferring this to that, making notes, writing songs, and I become manic, basically a hermit. But over the 9 days, lots of people came to visit the cave. Everybody I knew in London at the time dropped by day, but to me, it was just one long day. They'd been doing other things, whatever they had to do. They'd slept and brushed their teeth and shit, and I'm up there writing songs, reorganizing my sounds, and making double copies of everything. This was all on cassette in those days. And then I would get into artistically decorating the labels. The reggae one had a beautiful Lion of Judah. It was into the 9th day, and I was still, as far as I was concerned, in fine form. I remember I was going to copy one cassette onto another. I got it all down, noted which track, boom, pushed play. I turned around and fell asleep on my feet for 0.3 seconds. Then I fell forward and hit the JBL speaker, which woke me up. But worse than that, I couldn't see a thing. It was just a curtain of blood. There were 3 steps. I still remember them now. And I managed to miss every one. And I rolled over and fell asleep on the floor. I woke up with an encrusted face maybe a day later. 8 full days, and on the 9th day, he fell. The band was waiting for me in Toronto early in 1977. I put off going for many days. They sent me telegrams. "Where are you?" We had a gig at the Elmer Combo, which would provide more tracks for our Love You Live album. We needed some days of rehearsal. I couldn't, apparently, extract myself from the rituals of Old Church Street. And I had to get Anita on the road too, which was just as difficult. But finally, we flew there on February 24th. The gigs, two nights at the club, were scheduled for 10 days later. I took a hit on the airplane, and somehow the spoon ended up in Anita's pocket. They found nothing on me at the airport, but they found the spoon on Anita and busted her. Then they bided their time. They went a great effort to prepare the big bust of me in the Harbour Castle Hotel, knowing that they'd find something. Just follow the junkies. They had intercepted a package of stuff I'd sent ahead. Alan Dunn, the longest-serving Stones man, logistics and transport supremo, discovered later that the regular personnel who worked in the hotel suddenly found themselves working alongside many extra people who had been hired mostly as telephone and television engineers. The police were setting it up. Massive resources against one guitar player. The hotel manager would have known, but of course nobody tipped us off. To save money, Peter Rudge, the tour manager, had taken any personnel off the floor. So the police came straight to the room. Marlin would not normally have let in any policemen, but they were dressed as waiters. They couldn't wake me up. By law, you have to be conscious to be arrested. It took them 45 minutes. I'd been up for 5 days, and I'd had a heavy-duty shot, and I was out. This was my last rehearsal day, and I'd been asleep for about 2 hours. My memory of it is waking up and them going slap, slap. Two Mounties dragging me about the room, slapping me, trying to get me conscious. Bang, 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 bang. Who are you? What's your name? Do you know where you are and do you know why we're here? My name's Keith Richards and I'm in the Harbour Hotel. What you're doing here, I have no idea. Meanwhile, they'd found my stash, and it was about an ounce, quite a lot, no more than a man needs. I mean, it wouldn't feed the city, but obviously they knew their shit, like I knew my shit, and it was clearly not that Canada smack. It had come from England. I'd put it in the flight case. So they arrest me, take me to this Mountie police station, and it's really not my time of day. They put me through the books and everything, and because of the amount they found, they decided to charge me with trafficking, which is an automatic jail sentence for a very long time in Canada. I said, okay, fine, give me a gram back. Oh, we can't do that. I said, so what are you going to do now? You know I need it and that I'm going to have to get it. What are you going to do? Follow me and bust me again? Is that your game? How are you going to play this? Give me some back till I figure this out. Oh, no, no. And that was when Bill Wyman came through. Bill was the first one to come around and say, is there anything I can do? And I said, quite honestly, I'm out of shit and I need some shit. And of course, that's not Bill's area, but he said, I'll see what I can do. And he found somebody. We'd been working at the Elmer Combat Club, so we had local connections. Bill came through and got some shit to get me off the hook, over the hill. And that was a big risk for Bill, considering the attention I was getting. That was about the closest emotional thing that I can remember with Bill. The Mounties never did try to bust me again. I was quoted as saying, what is on trial is the same thing that's always been on trial. Dear old them and us. I find this hall a bit weary. I've done my stint in the fucking dock. Why don't they pick on the Sex Pistols? Yet again, someone was seriously after my ass. And the situation was further complicated by Margaret Trudeau, the wife of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, moving into the hotel as a stone's appendage, offering a double big tabloid story. The Prime Minister's young wife with the stones, and you throw in drugs, you're looking at a 3-month run. In the end, it may have played in my favour, but at the time, it was the worst combination of circumstances. Margaret Trudeau was 22, and Trudeau was 51 when they got married. It was a bit like Sinatra, Mia Farrow, the power and the flower child. And now Trudeau's bride, and this was exactly their 6th wedding anniversary, was seen walking in our corridors in a bathrobe. So then the story was that she had left him. She had, in fact, moved into the room next to Ronnie, and they were hitting it off really well. Or as Ronnie put it so nicely in his memoirs, we shared something special for that short time. She flew to New York to escape the publicity, but Mick flew to New York as well. So it was assumed they too were an item. Worse and worse. She was a groupie. That's all she was. Pure and simple. Nothing wrong with that. But you shouldn't be a Prime Minister's wife if you want to be a groupie. I'm out on a bond of many dollars, but they took my passport and I'm released only to the hotel. So I'm trapped. And I'm still waiting to see if they're going to jail me. They're shooting fish in a barrel. At another hearing, they added a charge of cocaine possession and revoked bail. But we got off that on a technicality. I would have loved to have dared them to put me in jail. It was all bullshit. They didn't have the balls. They weren't feeling confident. The rest of the band left Canada out of caution, and quite wisely so. I was the first one to say, you fuckers, get out of here. They're only going to involve you. Let me take the heat. It's my heat. It was quite likely that jail time was on the cards. I was facing a probable 2 years, according to my lawyers. It was Stu who suggested that I should use the waiting time to put down some tracks of my own. Put something down to remember the man by. He hired a studio, beautiful piano, and a microphone. The result has been doing the circuit for a while. KR's Toronto bootleg. We just did all the country songs. Nothing different from what I do any other night. But there was a certain poignancy about it because at that moment, things looked a bit grim. I played the George Jones, Hoagy Carmichael, Fats Domino songs I'd played with Graham. Merle Haggard's Sing Me Back Home is pretty poignant anyway. The warden is taking the prisoner down the hall to his execution. Sing me back home with a song I used to hear. Sing me back home before I die. Once again, it was Bill Carter who came to my rescue. Carter's problem was that in 1975, he had assured the visa-issuing authorities that there were no problems with drugs. Now, I'm busted in Toronto for drug trafficking. Carter had flown straight to Washington, not to visit his friends in the State Department or immigration, who had told him that I would never be allowed into America again, to the White House. First, He had assured the Canadian court when he posted my bond that I had a medical problem and that I needed to be cured of my heroin addiction. He made the same case to his contacts in the White House, where Jimmy Carter was president, using all the political muscle he could work, talking to one counsel.